BehindTheBook.com.
Hello once again, everybody, and thank you for joining me here on this Tuesday, September 10th edition of Bang the Book Radio. My name is Adam Burke, your host for the next hour or so, as we go over all kinds of things in the world of sports from a betting focus. Happy to have you with me here for this Tuesday edition of the broadcast. Two very smart handicapping minds join me. The first, Brian Blessing, the host of Sportsbook Radio and Vegas Hockey Hotline. We'll chat some NFL week one to week two reactions, take a look at a couple of games for you. Then also, of course, as if things weren't busy enough, the PGA Tour returns this week with a military tribute at the Greenbrier. So we'll break down this week's golf event with Brian. Second half of today's show, professional handicapper Rolf Michaels from WagerTalk.com will join me. We'll start in college football with some week two to week three thoughts, go over three games for you at the top of the card, then also take a look from NFL week one to week two and go over a couple of games with Rolf as well. Over at BangTheBook.com, we are your one-stop shop for sports betting news and information. Lots and lots of great content being posted over there already early on in the week. My college football power ratings, opening line reports for college football and the NFL, recaps of how we did in the Westgate Super Contest and the Circa Million, college football situational betting tips. Also, we've got a WNBA playoff preview. The playoffs start tomorrow night in women's basketball. We'll have NASCAR, golf, soccer, tennis, UFC, all kinds of great stuff over there on a daily and weekly basis over at BangTheBook.com. As you know, this and every edition of Bang the Book Radio presented by our friends over at DSI Sportsbook. BTB, the number 200, is that promo code. 100% deposit match bonus for the sportsbook. 100% deposit match bonus for the live casino at BetDSI. It's only a game until you bet it. Finally, before I bring Brian onto the show, I had a little bit of a monologue on yesterday's program talking about the mental side of this industry. Got some very positive feedback from some listeners via email, some positive feedback via Twitter as well. I really appreciate that. As you know, I've never shied away from talking about some of the mental health problems that I've had in the past, whenever these topics come up here on the program. And I know that it can be a very, very tough industry. So I appreciate those that reached out, and if anybody ever needs to reach out, adam@bangthebook.com via email, the best way to get in contact with me. All right, so with that, we bring the first of two guests onto the program here for today. That is Brian Blessing, the host of Sportsbook Radio and Vegas Hockey Hotline. Brian, how's it going today, man?
Hey, Adam, how you doing, buddy?
Doing very well, man. Appreciate your time as always here, sir. And you and I were talking for a couple minutes before the show. Hey, you know what? There's really no break now for the next several months. And in fact, it's what, 3.5 weeks until the Golden Knights get going?
Their rookie showcase wraps up today in California. Then the rookies come home, training camp end of this week. Preseason game Sunday, short preseason, and the opener is October 2nd. So the hockey season's ready to roll. So I'm jacked about that. Hockey's an awesome sport in terms of opportunities that are on the board, and optimistic about the Sabres. That's one of the true joys I get during the long season is watching them and love the league and see what teams are going to be good. I think there are a lot of teams that did a lot of things in the off season. And by the way, Adam, you still had like 7 or 8 of extremely high-end restricted free agents that have not signed. I've never seen a year like this where the league is completely bogged down. And once one or two of these guys go, then the rest of them probably will go. But there have been no trades. Adam, this is going to be an insane 3 weeks. There are going to be hockey trades all over the place. The teams just don't know what they're doing with the salary cap. This is going to be an insane month.
Yeah, some teams expected a little bit more of a salary cap increase. They wind up not getting it. Zach Werenski just signed for Columbus yesterday, I saw. I think it was only a 3-year deal for him. But, yeah, I mean, it's crazy. And, look, I mean, obviously all the attention's on football here. But something to keep in mind for us as we go throughout our segments here this season, and maybe we'll try to work some more NHL in with you here this year, Brian. Everybody watches the NFL. Everybody follows the NFL. It's a tight market. But it's not a bad idea if you've got some downtime to start taking a look at the NHL, because I think that's a market where you can win.
Oh, no. Pal, I think their soft numbers – that pop up on a nightly basis on hockey, specifically on some totals. I don't think enough value is put in when backups go in. But the other thing that's crazy is, you know, the markets that are up there now, odds to win a division, but specifically regular season points, you can form an opinion, I think, on some teams that are, you know, pretty much you know what you're dealing with. But there are a lot of gray areas where, you know, there are indexes that are just sitting there that I don't know how in good conscience you can step up and make a play, because all of a sudden you make a play and then there's a blockbuster deal. It's a completely different animal. And there are a lot of teams out there that need stuff, and that they're gonna be moves.
Well, not to hijack this segment, of course, you can find some NHL videos over on our Bang the Book YouTube page that Brian did here over the off season, and talked about some of those point totals, things of that sort as well. So make sure you head on over to our Bang the Book YouTube page and check that out. Brian, week one in the NFL, I think my biggest takeaway, and you and I have talked about this before, I think you could take a bunch of bros, sit in their dorm room, ripping Natterdays, playing Madden, and they have a better idea of game management and clock management than these NFL coaches do.
It drives me insane, Adam. It's long been a pet peeve of mine. I say it all the time, and it's like a broken record. But I would love to actually do, and I'm not going to do it, but if somebody out there wants to do a study, and actually say, yes, a bonehead coaching decision, mismanaging timeouts, resulted in a different outcome. I bet you there are 50, 60 games in the NFL alone. It's unforgivable. I'll say it at the beginning of a brand new year, but you watch how many times it happens, man. They're oxygen tanks. Take a delay of game penalty. Don't waste the timeout. And the crazy ones are, you know, when it's 3rd and 18 and the play clock's coming down and the guy takes a timeout in a 3-point game in the third quarter, take the 5-yard penalty, run a draw, and punt the football. You need the timeout at the end of the game. Detroit is absolutely unforgivable. What everybody's talking about in the Detroit game is the timeout that was called at the last second on a play that got a first down that would have iced the game. Okay, that's bad enough. But, okay, if they were in a bad spot, they didn't get it, then the guy was a hero. But the point was, Adam, they were ahead the whole game. They're ahead the whole game. Arizona comes back, gets a touchdown. They get a 2-point conversion. Matt Stafford gets the ball back with 41 seconds left. We saw what Breeze did last night. You know, you take away the middle of the field. He could have gone down. He needed 35 yards to go down, get a field goal, win the game, and get the hell out of there. They were ahead the whole game. They get the ball with 41 seconds left. They had no timeouts. How is that possible? Why are you taking timeouts when you're ahead?
I don't know. Bill O'Brien blows two timeouts and one challenge last night. It's a disaster. I don't understand these guys. And not even just the clock management element of it, too. I mean, which definitely comes into play. Why in the hell would you ever run the football on 2nd and 10? I have no idea why so many coaches do this every Sunday, hell, every Saturday in college football. I don't understand it, man. What good is it to be 3rd and 8 or 3rd and 7 every possession? I don't understand this for the life of me. I mean, the NFL is about getting 3rd and short and moving the chains, not 3rd and 7, 3rd and 12, 3rd and a mile. These guys are clueless, man. You would think by now, with all the analytics that are out there, these teams would put some game theory experts on the sidelines and tell these coaches, this guy's going to tell you what to do in this situation. You call the play that you want, but he's going to tell you what you're going to do, because these guys are just, they're not setting their teams up for success. And it's maddening to be betting on these coaches that have no effing clue what they're doing.
How about watch football now? You know, when it's 3rd and an inch or 4th and a half yard, college football, a lot. But now you're telling me the NFL's doing this? It's a quarterback sneak is a good thing. It's 3rd or 4th and a half yard, and the quarterback's in the shotgun. I mean, what are you doing? It's insanity. Texas Tech used to drive me nuts with Leach. He does it now at Washington State. You know, race up this creative mind and all these plays, and you pass the ball, and you're all over the place. Then you get the fourth and a foot, and they can't get an inch to save their life, and they snap the ball back 6 yards to somebody, and they never get the first down. Who makes this stuff up?
I don't understand. You got coaches kicking field goals when they're down by a bunch of points. Pittsburgh did it. Arizona did it. I mean, it didn't come back to hurt Arizona, but, you know, still, I mean, I don't understand these coaching decisions. Punting in plus territory, you know, kicking field goals to make it, to keep a two-score game, I don't understand what is happening here. What runs through the minds of these guys who are paid millions of dollars, and their job on game day is to put their teams in the best position to win the game. And they're just actively not doing it. And there's just not enough repercussion for this type of stuff. I don't know. I don't know what's going on here. But when you look at the NFL in week one, 8 head coaches in new spots, 6 brand new head coaches. Matt LaFleur is the only head coach, either new or in a new spot, that won a game. New head coaches 1-7 straight up here this week in the NFL. I don't know when this league gets a clue.
Did you see the end of the first half last night of the New Orleans game?
I did.
Okay. Can someone please explain this to me? Could you imagine, is this what would happen? Let me take what happened last night and change the scenario. It's the Super Bowl. And the team's down by 1, and they're driving down a point. And a pass is thrown, and there's a close play in terms of whether it was a spot, whether it was a first down or not. And they come running up, and they run a quarterback sneak, just like what happened last night. But there are 9 seconds left in the game. They get the first down. They're in field goal range. And if they get the first down, they're going to get up, spike the ball, and kick the game-winning kick for the Super Bowl. But because somebody upstairs decided to buzz down to make sure whether it was or wasn't a first down, and the play stood, but then they're getting ready to line up the winning kick for the Super Bowl, you're telling me that the official would walk up on the microphone and go, because the guy upstairs decided to challenge the play, there's a 10-second runoff, the game is over. Is that what could actually happen? That was insane.
I don't know. I have no idea.
Am I right? Am I right about that? That's insane. They didn't ask for the challenge. They didn't challenge. The buzz came from upstairs, and yes, it was a close play, but because it was buzzed down, there's a 10-second runoff? And don't kid yourself. I said before it happened eons ago, and I was covering the team doing the broadcast. I said, the day will come. They're going to end up handing out a Stanley Cup on this no goal. They did. I mean, could you imagine the Super Bowl, that happening?
It's crazy.
That's got to be changed. That's insanity. They had 26 seconds. The kid was tackled with 40 seconds left. The spot was, the ball was a half yard short. They ran up, did a quarterback sneak, low ball. The Saints were on a quarterback sneak. Imagine that. Get a first down, and then the buzz comes down. And they say, oh, yeah, no, it was short. The call was right, but there's a 10-second run-up because we decided to look at it. That's a disaster waiting to happen.
Well, and to bring this back to the betting side of things, I mean, the NFL is maddening enough to try and play and try and beat because it's such an efficient market. But now you're looking at these coaches who are making, you know, minus EV decisions all over the league. It makes it even harder to win betting the NFL. I mean, it's hard enough, like I said, as it is. But then you get some dunce of a coach who has no idea what he's doing. I mean, at this point, you really have to seriously handicap the coaches, handicap their play-calling tendencies, see who's actually throwing the football on first down so they don't get, you know, second and 10, second and 8, second and 9, all this type of thing. you've really got to pay attention to the play callers here, the people that are making these decisions. Yeah, maybe the players execute, maybe they don't. But I think handicapping the coaches in the NFL is far more important than ever because of all these wrong decisions being made.
Oh, hey, listen. You know, I've said forever, Mark Lawrence is a good friend, does the Playbook magazine, and we've been doing, you know, stuff on my radio show with him forever and a day. And I always gave him a lot of credit for this. When his magazine and the stuff, a lot of the stuff he talks about are the coordinators in college football and the change, the pace of play, the style, you know, and what new coach comes in, what kind of staff did he compile. When Sarkisian went to Washington, he spent like $2 million on assistant coaches, and that team was terrific right out of the gate. That stuff matters. And honestly, Adam, there are two things. I mean, and this is, we're turning this into a really broad discussion about a lot of things. But I sit there and say, at the end of the day, if you're really torn, numbers where it should be, or I like this, but you're trying to get a determining factor of whether to play a game or not. Honestly, it should maybe be the starting point, but to me it would be the one that puts you over the top is the coaching matchup. I believe in this coach, you know, way more than this guy. I mean, the Patriots are probably a bad example because they're just so good all over the place. But at the end of the day, if you got Belichick going against O'Brien, I mean, shouldn't that be worth 2.5 points? You know, the coaches should matter. And the other one that drives me nuts that I think is a flawed deal, yeah, is the run, stop the run, the things we always say, the generic things, and the coaches always say, we were great in all three phases of the game, offense, defense, special teams. No one puts 10 seconds of work into special teams. I mean, that should be factored into a wagering line. If a team is in the top five in the NFL on special teams, their punters always pinning teams at the 10. You know, they average 12 yards of punt return, and, you know, their special teams are terrific. That means they're winning the field position battle. That's a big factor. Does anybody say, oh, yeah, I really like, you know, Team X because they're really good on special teams? No. But you go over the course of the season, the special teams unit's probably the difference in 3 or 4 games.
Yeah, that's an excellent point because everybody in the NFL moves the ball at this point in time. I mean, it just is. It's a quarterback-driven league. Everybody moves the football. But if you're going 85 yards every drive instead of, you know, 65 or 70 yards every drive, that does make a difference. I completely agree with you that special teams, definitely something that we need to focus on a lot more here. And again, I mean, that's a coaching thing. You know, some coaches really care about special teams. Some coaches kind of put it on the back burner. And by the end of the year, you know those teams that do play pretty well on special teams. And it does have an impact. You're absolutely correct. So that's a very excellent point by you.
I bet you, buddy, this team, you know, the top of five defense, or they're in the top five in the league in takeaways. If they're the top, but the thing is, there's a difference. Top five in the league in takeaways, you know, if you break that down, are they creating those turnovers in their own red zone? You know, okay, great, good defense. They're turning those turnovers, or they're preventing field goals, or they're preventing points. But if that team is in the top 10 in takeaways and they're in the top 5 in special teams, those turnovers they're creating are short fields and are automatic points. And nobody talks about special teams.
All right, so let's see if we have any special teams or any additional thoughts here for the couple of games I wanted to talk about with you, including the Thursday night game here, Tampa Bay and Carolina. Carolina, 6.5-point favorite here in this one. Total on this game in the 50 range. Of course, we saw Tampa Bay's total go up a little bit here in week one against San Francisco, and that was not an offensive showcase for either team. But, you know, this short week game, Brian, in week two, you know, you get back into the flow of playing. The starters actually play a full game. Now all of a sudden you got to turn around and play a quick division matchup on Thursday.
Yeah, this one, buddy, this is a tough one for me. I thought Tampa Bay was a good play on Sunday, and honestly, it was their own ineptness that cost them that game. And by the way, I thought Arians made, you know, he's a hero if it works, but they're down 6, third quarter. They get a penalty, makes it 4th and goal at the 2. I was like, there's an eternity left. Kick the field goal. He goes for it. They don't get it. Then they get a turnover. They were already in field goal range. That game would have been tied had he kicked the field goal. Then Tampa's not later back in their own end, needing a touchdown, and Winston throwing one of the worst passes in the history of football. You know, the Tampa Bay gave that game away. I mean, the Niners stole a football game. That Tampa thing, I don't know what you do there. And Carolina's competitive. You know, there's some good players there. But basically, it's McCaffrey and Kuechly, you know, that do everything for this team. They're going to have their weeks where it works, but, you know, you get the right coach, takes one of those guys away, and I don't know. Carolina is sketchy. I don't like the game at all. I mean, you know, but Tampa going on the road on the Thursday night games, honestly, we enjoyed the Monday night doubleheader. Wouldn't the Monday night doubleheader be better and scrap the Thursday night games, and then these teams get literally one day of preparation for these Thursday night games?
Yeah, I think that's a much better call. I think the Players Association would like that too, because the players have never liked this Thursday night game. I mean, they always complain about it. Week 1, week 2, week 14, it doesn't matter. They complain about this Thursday night game, and I can't blame them. I mean, you know, you think of the lack of recovery time. At least if you play on Monday night, you still get, you know, most of the week at least. You play on Thursday night, you get very little time. I completely agree. We should just have a Monday night doubleheader and scratch the Thursday game. As far as this one goes in particular, I mean, maybe this one's a teaser candidate for you with Carolina. You bring them down to about a pick 'em, tease the total up, because Tampa Bay's defense did play pretty well last week. Carolina's defense, not so much, but Tampa Bay is not the Los Angeles Rams, as we all know. So maybe a 6-point teaser, Carolina down to virtually a pick 'em, move the total up to 55.5. Hope it's a lower scoring game with the quick turnaround. But you know, that's the thing. I mean, early on here in the NFL season, all of these teams are kind of trying to find their ways, especially with what we saw in the preseason. So, you know, laying big numbers, I think, especially in the short week game, is a little bit dangerous. But again, you do have Tampa Bay with a new coaching staff. So, you know, maybe the short week favors Carolina with more continuity. I don't know. I agree with you. I think it's a little bit of a tough game. Maybe you have some stronger thoughts here on the Colts and Titans game, game 261, 262. First game on the board by rotation order on Sunday. Tennessee, a 3-point favorite with extra juice off of that blowout win over Cleveland.
The one thing I say generically about week two, and I don't know if we did this specifically on this podcast today, and things are all running together on me, but week two and week 17 are the most bizarre weeks in the NFL. Because everybody saw last week, oh, man, okay, there you go. That team looked great. They're going to come in. They're going to kill this team. But teams circle the wagons, because if you go 0-2, 87% of the time, you miss the playoffs. So the teams that lost the first game of the year literally are playing this game like a playoff game. They know that number. And so don't go overboard with what you last saw. The Colts, you know, played their hearts out. Vinatieri let them down. But you talk about travel. You know, yeah, it's not the end of the world. The travel thing's not that big a deal. But Tennessee, they had all summer listening to all this Cleveland hype. And we must have talked about this 100 times in the summer. Tennessee's a physical football team. You don't know what you're going to get one day to the next. But I think Vrabel knows what he's doing. They were sick of hearing about Cleveland. They wanted to go in there and punch them in the mouth. They're like, really? We're sick of hearing about Cleveland. Now Tennessee gets the big win. They come home opener, should be all jacked and life is rosy. But Indy doesn't want to go 0-2, and Tennessee conceivably sitting in the letdown spot.
Yeah, I mean, as I look at this game, I think I kind of like Indianapolis at the outset. I know they went to overtime, and the teams that come off of an overtime game do not do well the following week. I imagine Rolf in our next segment probably has that in front of him. I don't have it in front of me right now. We'll get it here at some point throughout the course of the show. You know, teams that go to overtime generally don't do well the following week. The thing that concerns me about Tennessee here, you know, you look at their offensive performance in that game against the Browns. They ran the football for 4.5 yards per carry. That's solid. That's good enough. You know, they didn't have too many chunk plays. They had 3 rushes of 10 yards or more. But you look at them in the passing game, 151-yard play, a 75-yard scamper for Derrick Henry. I'm worried about this team's ability to sustain offensive drives. Another new offensive coordinator this year for Tennessee. I think I'm probably going to be on Indianapolis. If I can find a hook, I'll be pretty thrilled to get it. But I think Indy can move the football both ways. I don't believe that about Tennessee. I think Indy's defense is better than they played last week as well. So I actually have a little bit of a stronger opinion on this game looking at the dog.
Oh, and I could concur with that. Maybe I'd have a slight lean to the under, too, that they move the ball between the 20s and don't punch it in. I mean, don't forget the Tennessee game changed on a dime, on a two-yard pass, and Derrick Henry runs 75 yards. You know, one play, and the whole thing blew up. I just want to throw one goofy thing out there, and I could be a complete fool for saying this, but don't forget, last year, and I don't, you know, we know about Baltimore, and they win in the preseason. Well, the other thing is, last year, Harbaugh, the Bills ended up with the second-best defense in the league. Yeah, Peterman was playing and turned the ball over a bunch. If it weren't for the opening game, the Bills had the number one defense in the league, and they came out and had a great game against the Jets again. But Baltimore beat the Bills 47-3 last year and then went and lost the next week to Cincinnati. So Baltimore did the same thing to Miami, and all we're talking about is how rotten and horrific and Miami's tanking and this and that. I don't know what it is about Harbaugh. They dial stuff up for that opening game. But I wonder if Miami's not as horrific as we all think, because Baltimore did the same damn thing last year. And it's week one's goofy, week two's goofy.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. Of course, you've got Miami in week two. Miami is an 18.5 or 19-point underdog, which is absolutely remarkable at home, no less. Then Arizona going to Baltimore, getting almost two touchdowns. Total shot up in that game. But that's kind of an interesting one here, too, where, again, maybe you do have some of that overreaction with those two big double-digit dogs. I do want to spend a few minutes here on the golf side of things with you, Brian. Not a lot of big names here at the Greenbrier Classic this is in. I believe it's White Sulphur Springs, West Virginia. By the way, there is a sports book there for anybody who's heading up to this one. But this is a very – I mean, this tournament being in September is kind of weird. Not a long break for the start of the wraparound schedule. Bryson DeChambeau, your favorite, 12-1. Victor Hovland was great last season, 14-1. Jason Kokrak was very good, too. He's 16-1. Joaquin Niemann played well at the end of the year, 22-1. I mean, does anything that happened at the tail end of last season matter going into this tournament, Brian?
There's something that happened a couple of weeks ago. It's funny, I was doing another podcast yesterday morning, and the numbers weren't out yet. And so we were just going through the field. And knock on wood, we did a pretty good job. Said, oh, this guy, yeah, DeChambeau will probably be the favorite. Hovland's got to take it. And we did, and then the numbers popped up 5 minutes later. And some of the guys we had identified that would stick out in what you'd call a depleted field. I like Hovland's current form better than DeChambeau's at 16-1. The kid's going to win, and it could happen early. I thought Cam Smith in this field is a guy you could take a look at 40-1. And another guy that seems to be a lot closer to kicking the door down. He contends more consistently. Now it's a question of winning. He's almost kind of like a Charlie Hoffman type who finally at some point a couple years ago learned how to win a little bit. Is Scott Piercy at 40-1. But in terms of what we just saw, and it flies under the radar, Tom Lewis is 66-1. All right? Lewis is a Brit who was playing on the European Tour. At the last minute, Adam, he made the decision, you know, I'm going to run over and I'm going to go to the Korn Ferry Tour Championship, which is basically the opportunity for the top 25 guys to get their PGA card. Some of the most insane pressure in that tournament. It was amazing to watch. But that course was set up nasty. There was like 5-inch rough. It was nuts. This guy, Tom Lewis, won that tournament 2 weeks ago by 5 shots. He was hitting at 320 off the tee. He was flag hunting, and the hole was like a manhole cover to him. And then at the end of it, they were saying, well, he's got to make a decision now. Does he go back to the European Tour and play this fall swing, or might he just stick here right now and ride the wave on the wraparound tour? So the question was, where's the guy going to go? He stayed. He's playing in this thing. What I saw 2 weeks ago, if this guy, you know, didn't, because he's playing with house money, he got his tour card on the PGA Tour, he can come play in this event instead of the European Tour event and play for five times the money, and he's walking in here, and there ain't a soul on the planet who knows who this guy is. He should be 20-1. If he plays the way he played on that Korn Ferry Tour Championship, because he won in a walk when guys were life and death trying to make the tour. Tom Lewis, no one's ever heard of him. He's an Englishman. He just got his PGA Tour card. He's my top pick.
There you go. Definitely a good one to look at here for this tournament, which, you know, we do have some course form data, but, you know, maybe the course plays a little bit different in September. I don't know. It's cooled off a little bit in this area. This course is kind of up in the mountains a little bit. So I'm sure this course will be soft. I'm sure it'll be, you know, a little bit more lush than we've seen a lot of these courses be. So, you know, maybe the rough is a little bit thicker. The greens could be, you know, a little bit thicker, maybe a little bit slower. This thing, you know, Kevin Na won the last one 2 years ago. We know he gets hot with the putter. So is that kind of part of your handicap too? Are you looking at a putting contest here?
I told you that. I think I've told that story before. The week before the Greenbrier was last year. He's the defending champ, right?
Yeah, it was last year. It wasn't during the previous season, but yeah, it was last year.
Well, it was earlier in the year, if memory serves, because this was one that was moved later to the year because of the schedule. I told the story. I'm playing. I went to play this place, Southern Highlands, here in Vegas last year. It's a fancy place. You got to have a caddy. I'm like, oh boy. You know, I'm in there raking my own shots, and the caddy's like, what are you doing? I felt guilty. The guy's like, no, it's my job. I'm like, okay, whatever. But before we go to play, we go to check in. The guy that set up the round of golf, we're talking to the guy at the counter, talking to the pro. And he goes, oh, yeah, Kevin Na was here last week. He was on the practice range. He practices at Southern Highlands. He said, yeah, he changed drivers. He gave, I think, a Titleist driver, and he said he was hitting the hell out of it off the tee. And he said, I think it was Top Flight. He called and got out of his contract. He's playing Top Flight equipment. He says, this driver, he's killing this driver. He scrapped his whole sponsorship deal because he was hitting that driver so good. This is the week before the thing. Right? Kevin Na goes, you know, he's running away winning this thing. And I'm sitting there with tears in my eyes. That he's like at 80-1, he's winning this tournament. And I'm looking at him. No ads, no sponsors on his shirt. He's wearing a hat, SOHI. So high. What the hell's that? You know, it's like, what is that? It's Southern Highlands. He had no sponsorship. He's wearing the Southern Highlands golf hat. He goes and wins the tournament the first week he got out of his contract and changed drivers. And the guy told me about it 2 days before they teed off when I did nothing about it.
That's a great story. And you can definitely hear some great stories from Brian, both here on Bang the Book Radio, but also on Sportsbook Radio and Vegas Hockey Hotline. Brian, how can people check out those two shows?
Sportsbookradio.com. We're going to be doing some football videos. We'll get a Greenbrier video up at bangthebook.com. You can follow me at Brian Blessing, and love joining you every Tuesday, bud. It's funny, you know, once the season starts, you know, you get into the rhythm and the routine of it, and I'm glad this is part of the routine. I go to bed Monday night, so I'm talking to Adam Tuesday morning. Pencil it in, man.
There you go, man. I really appreciate that. Once again, Brian Blessing, Sportsbook Radio and Vegas Hockey Outline, the two shows, at Brian Blessing on Twitter. Brian, appreciate your time as always, man. Thank you so much for joining me. We'll talk to you again next week.
Have a great day, Adam. Thanks, bud.
There you go. Brian Blessing again, at Brian Blessing on Twitter. And make sure you check out his work over on our Bang the Book YouTube channel. We got one more guest here for this Tuesday edition of the program. That is professional handicapper Rolf Michaels from WagerTalk.com. Rolf, how's it going today, man?
Well, we've got a couple weeks of college in the books and a week of NFL in the books. It's now officially football season.
Yes, it definitely is. And I got to say here, as I was going through my power ratings for week three and as I was kind of looking over this NFL card for week two, these are the 2 weeks that probably concern me the most in these respective leagues, because you don't get that week one to week two overreaction in college football. You get it now in week three. And week two of the NFL, I mean, you know, who knows what we may get from some of these teams here this week. You kind of feeling the same way, or are you pretty confident with where you're at?
College. I had a poor week in college, so that's a rarity for me in week two. Made some wrong decisions, leaving the wrong teams off, but that happens. I feel pretty good. I like the adjustments in college, and I think now I get into my strength. These weeks three, four, first couple weeks of conference play, where the public is overreacting because of the strength of schedule and the type of game that was played. Versus the competition they have for the upcoming weeks.
So as we look around here, and I do notice that, of course, some of the sides that I was a little bit too scared to play yesterday kind of moving in the direction I expected them to. So that's a little bit disappointing. But in terms of the adjustments that you made, Rolf, from week two to week three, who were some of the biggest movers for you, either up or down?
Well, I moved USC and UM Monroe up three. I think what we saw of USC is legit. People all thought JT Daniels, and people thought Sears transferred out, and people thought this USC offense is going to struggle. But I'll tell you what, he's the real deal. He might have only been a three-star coming out of high school, but USC has no concerns in my book. I was excited the way they finally let their offense go. Clay Helton had no part of calling the plays. It was very obvious. They didn't take their foot off the gas, and they impressed. You know, my teams that went down three, I have four of them. Florida State, who I now have down 6 points. I moved three the week before in their loss to Boise. I moved three more in their one-point win. I have UMass down three. They keep moving down as being the worst team. I have Stanford down three. You know, even if KJ Costello's back, this is a team that was outgained last year. I mentioned that before. 9 or 10 wins on the season, but they were outgained. Now without their left tackle going into UCF, I think they're going to struggle this week. And, of course, I have UCLA down three more, you know, after their horrid performance against San Diego State. So on the year, I have Tennessee down 7 from my openers, Florida State down 6, UCLA down 5, FIU down 4.5. Stanford and Nebraska down 4. On the positives, Wisconsin plus 5, SMU and Maryland plus 4.5, North Carolina plus 4, UCF, Oregon, and Georgia State plus 3.5.
Yeah, that sounds like it's fairly in the same range of what I've kind of been looking at here as well. And, you know, there are a few teams. I've actually moved North Carolina up 6 points here so far this season. I think that's one where we do have a little bit of a difference of opinion, but as far as moving teams down, you and I are mostly in the same boat there. And, you know, what's really difficult is, and I'll use FIU as an example because we talked about them on yesterday's show too. You know, this is a team that we expected to be pretty good. This is a team that we expected to come out and play well. They were returning so much of last year's production. And for whatever reason, it just hasn't happened. And those are the challenging ones to me. You know, if you've got to move a team down that lost a whole bunch from last year, and it winds up being more of a problem than you originally thought, that's one thing. If it's a team that brought back most of its personnel, not a whole lot of coaching turnover, and they're bad, that's another thing. I think those are the most difficult ones to try and figure out.
Well, I did watch the FIU Western Kentucky game. I actually had a play on the over and lost that. And yeah, I'll mention my losers as well. That was an ugly total. But James Morgan did get hurt in the first quarter. So, you know, they went to Kalen Wiggins, who cannot throw the ball. He's a running quarterback. He was 2 of 6. They were totally inept. Now, yes, you know, I take the Morgan injury into effect. He's questionable this week. We'll see if he comes back. But this was also the same offense that was at Tulane and only put up 16 first downs and 267 yards. So there's more to the offense that is just James Morgan's injury. But again, that's one of those with an asterisk that you have to keep an eye back. If Morgan comes back and healthy, we'll see what the offense does. If it's Kalen Wiggins, FIU is going to be in for some low scoring games.
Well, and there are a few other teams we'll talk about here from an adjustment standpoint, because I want to look at a couple of games specifically involving West Virginia and Maryland, a couple of teams I'm sure have moved for both of us here. But, you know, just in general here, Rolf, I mean, I've noticed that my power ratings in week two were pretty good. You know, a lot of games moved towards my numbers. I was close on a lot of games. Here this week, I notice I've got more games where I'm, you know, 6-7 points off of the market than I had in week two. I don't know if that's the case for you or not, but you know, should that concern me that I've got more games where I've got a much larger overlay in week three?
You know, I don't know the answer to that, Adam. I don't. I have fewer games. I only have a handful of games that even got to the six-point range. My biggest one is Stanford and UCF. I'll just share that with our listeners. You know, that's you know when we answer that, Adam, is after week three, and we see where did those games finish closer to your power ratings, or did those finish closer to the Vegas number? And then until that point, no one knows what the right answer is. Is it good or is it bad? After week three, you'll go back, you'll make your adjustments, and you'll look. Yeah, I was this far off this week, and I was wrong. Perhaps I need to move them what I would normally move them, plus a little bit more because I was off on the market. Or you pat yourself on the back. Wow, out of these six games that I had a touchdown or more off, I went 5-1 or 4-2. I did a nice job. Let me look at the two games I lost and what I'm going to do from there. So we'll have to wait and see on that.
And I think it's one of those weeks, too, where, you know, we have – virtually no marquee games here this week, except for, I mean, really Iowa and Iowa State, probably the best of the games out there. And I mean, you wouldn't really think that with the history of those two programs. Obviously Iowa has been very consistent for a very long time. Iowa State was very much little brother in the state there for a while. Now Matt Campbell's kind of gotten that program going, but there are a lot of games here this week. You've got a lot of big numbers. You've got, you know, a Power Five team like Duke playing at Middle Tennessee, first non-Vanderbilt Power 5 team to go to Murfreesboro since 2011. You've got some big lines. You've got some very inconsistent types of teams. A TCU and Purdue, close line, but I don't know what I'm getting from either team. Texas Tech and Arizona, close line. Don't know what I'm going to get from either team. Do you find that this is a tough week, or do you feel like you've got, you know, several positions already that you either have taken or are going to take?
Well, you know, I'm going to give myself a shameless plug here. I have my first 5% play of the year up, and I put it up at Wager Talk. Normally it's $40. It's $9. I'm going to keep it $9 today as an added bonus. For those that don't know, at Wager Talk, every package is $9. And then I left it up for $9. So if someone wants to try my top play of the week, that's available there. And UCF is another game I have. You know, I think what I've learned from previous seasons is this. I'm very conservative with totals weeks 1 and 2, but weeks 3 and 4, I think I really get a lot more value with totals because of misleading scores, because of pace of play, because teams, you know, because of the schedule teams played. Sized wise, you know, there could be, you know, it's looking up where I'm probably going to have 4 or 5 sides that make my card and a handful of totals as well. So to me, it looks like a deep card. You know, some of my numbers are off, some of the situations I love, but I also agree with you. Teams that have only played one game are so hard to judge, and that's TCU. I mean, listen, they played Arkansas Pine Bluff. Yeah, they put up 500 yards, 480 some yards, and won that game 39-7. But you want to talk about what you don't know is, you know, they played both Dugan and Delton at quarterback. And now you play one FCS team at home, you have a bye week, and now you're going on the road to a Big Ten opponent. Clearly, a lot of questions for those teams that have only played once this season.
Well, of course, that line moving because it looks like Elijah Sindelar may not play for Purdue. He threw for 500 yards last week, but in concussion protocol here this week. So that's why TCU from +2 to -2. And, of course, as we get, you know, some more clarity on what's up with Sindelar, maybe we'll see, you know, that line kind of swing back a little bit. But it's a similar thing for Iowa and Iowa State, and going off script a little bit here, but you talk about those teams with one data point. Iowa State has one data point, and it's not a good one because they went to, what, triple overtime against Northern Iowa? Meanwhile, Iowa, a couple of decent data points for them, taking all the money here so far in early action. That's the thing, and we talk about this with college basketball a lot, and I think, what, college basketball starts 8 weeks from today, I think I saw on Twitter. But you talk about that a lot early on in the season, the strength of schedule discrepancies and how much they play a role. So I imagine you've got some games that kind of fall into that category this week here too.
It is. You know, I'm not going to have a play in the Iowa-Iowa State game, but I will tell you this. You go back and look at what the Cyclones did. We know Northern Iowa, this is clearly big brother scenario. This FCS program is very good, has had success in the past. These are kids that wanted to go play for Iowa State or Iowa and are now playing at Northern Iowa. Cyclones did have a 463-yard edge, and Purdy was 30 of 41 with two TDs and no interceptions. They just struggled to run the ball. Matt Campbell, in an article I read yesterday, says his favorite part of an entire season schedule is having a week two bye. This goes back to his Mount Union days. He says he will get more done with his team having played one game, having the bye game in before Iowa, that he is absolutely thrilled to be playing this game. Now, yes, Iowa had an easy time, but they still had to prepare for their Big Ten opener against Rutgers. You know, Rutgers came off that massive week one win. Iowa couldn't go into last week relaxing and saying, hey, let's split reps between Rutgers and Iowa State, where they had to prep for that conference opener. Iowa State, for 2 weeks after that Northern Iowa game, phew, we won the game. Let's look. We've got 14 days to Iowa. What can we do?
Well, and there are some strange situational spots here this week. There were some last week as well. Some teams playing a conference game, then all of a sudden stepping down and playing an FCS team or a really low group of five team. Then next week they get back into conference play. So some situational spots worth considering. And again, a situational spot is never the sole justification for a play. But I think if it strengthens your position or gets you potentially off of a position, you know, those are things that you want to factor in the equation as far as situational spots go.
You know, absolutely. And let me give you an example of where a situational spot completely changed. If at the beginning of the season you were looking at the Pitt Panthers, you would say they open up with a conference home opener against Virginia. Week three, they go on the road to Penn State. Ohio is clearly a sandwich game that they're going to look past. Well, since Pitt lost to Virginia and they have Penn State on deck, all of a sudden that Ohio game has a complete different focus where the Pitt Panthers and Pat Narduzzi don't want to start 0-2. What do? They go out against Ohio. They have a 481-212 edge. So it's funny how situational spots change from 1 week to the other depending on those results.
All right, so let's take a look at three games here in the college football card that I wanted to touch on with you here. And coincidentally, they're at the top of the rotation order for Saturday, starting with game 109-110, Ohio State and Indiana. Now, we know Ohio State has struggled with Indiana in the past. They've created some margin by the end of the game. They have had some issues in the first half in a handful of their games here against Indiana this decade. They're up from 14 to 15 and a half. I know I adjusted Ohio State up after last week's performance. A lot of people seem to do that. That's the question that you kind of have to ask yourself here is Ohio State that good? Did Cincinnati just have a bad week? You know, does it justify what we're seeing here with this line move against Indiana?
Well, I think the line move is justified. You know, Ohio State's defense has showed us that they're not going to be the defense that allowed 400 yards per game for the first time, I think, in the history of the school last year. And they are a legitimate defense. Yes, FAU and Cincinnati are not offensive powers, but, you know, the Lane Kiffin offense at FSU had moved the ball, and Cincinnati, you know, is Cincinnati. It's what you expect. I think for so many years that Ohio State just looked past Indiana. This is the lowest line in the series since 2014. So we've had 15 out of the last 15 years, I think 14 of the 15 were all three touchdown favorites or higher. So it's easy to look past that team. I don't think you look past them here in your first road game. Remember, people have trouble in Columbus getting tickets to Ohio State games. When you go and look at this Indiana game this Saturday, you're going to see at least 40% scarlet because the Ohio State fans can buy tickets to Indiana cheaper than they can in Columbus. It's worth the drive. It's a short drive, and you're going to have a huge home edge. Ohio State's won 23 straight in the series, but like you said, the Hoosiers have covered 7 out of 8. And, you know, you're talking a young quarterback now for Indiana. Yeah, Ramsey was the returning starter, but, you know, they decided to go with Penix, who's a lefty, who's a young quarterback. You know, and his first two defenses he faced, Ball State and Eastern Illinois, and yes, they put up a lot of yards, but again, neither of those are an issue. I actually like Ohio State. I mean, you're allowing 1.9 yards per carry on the season. You have 9 sacks in 2 games. I think Michael Penix is going to be in a little bit of trouble this week against the Ohio State defense.
Well, and what's always so interesting here about the early part of the college football season, and we'll look at Ohio State's, you know, resume specifically here, they beat up Florida Atlantic in the first quarter, then took a foot off the gas. They didn't want to show anything for that game against Cincinnati. They had the week one game won, basically 5 minutes into the game. Pretty much everybody knew that. Then Florida Atlantic goes out at home, gets decimated by Central Florida last week. Cincinnati, you know, nice win over UCLA in week one, didn't play particularly great, but still came away with the win and the relatively easy cover there, then blown out by Ohio State. So people really dropped UCLA down quite a bit because of their performances and also what happened in the Cincinnati game against the Buckeyes. So that's one of the things that's challenging about this early part of the year is that we start grading these teams and regrading their performances based on what happens to their previous opponents, you know, when they step up in class or something like that. So that's a challenge here at this time of the year too.
Yeah. You know, just a note, you know, how do you judge defenses? You know, you look at what the stats are, and then you look at what a team's offense is, and, you know, the adjusted defenses you see on the ESPN FPI or some of the other college football websites. But just to note, when we get into weeks 4 and 5 of the season, one of my favorite stats for judging offenses and defenses is above or below the average of what the opponents have. And this is something going back to the Phil Steele days that, you know, Phil has on his website where it shows the yardage. It shows the yardage in the game and how much above or below the season average of that team has. And that number always changes and adjusts because obviously a team's average changes. But it's something to gauge on when you have trouble defining strength of schedule. Well, this team played an FCS team and this played this and this and this. When you're judging a team against what a team does year to date on their averages, I think it gives you a very true test of how well or poorly that team played.
All right, so we go to game 113-114 here, NC State and West Virginia. And I think this game is kind of handicapping 201. You know, we get handicapping 101. It's a very simple, you know, very straightforward handicap. I think this game is anything but, because I've been very impressed with North Carolina State here so far. In fact, I moved them up 4 points in my power ratings because I was worried about what they lost from last season, losing Ryan Finley, lost a 1,000-yard rusher, lost a 1,000-yard receiver. They lost some big things. Now, it may be crazy to move them up 4 points because they've played East Carolina and Western Carolina, and they've won those two games combined 75-6. Now, it hasn't been a good look for West Virginia, but James Madison is a great FCS team, and Missouri is a top 20, you know, maybe borderline top 15 power-rated team for a lot of people out there. So this is a hard handicap to me where – I want to believe in what NC State has done, and I'm doing that with my power ratings adjustment. Also, they really haven't played anybody that West Virginia has played here so far, and they're laying about a touchdown in Morgantown.
Yeah, this really is. I agree with you. This is a watch and learn game. It's a game I'm not going to have a play on. How often do you see teams with only 9 returning starters come back with a new head coach in the Neil Brown era? You've seen an offense that in 2 games has had 26 first downs, 13 first downs against James Madison, 13 first downs at Missouri. But again, can Matthew McKay do what he did those first 2 games? I mean, he's completed 67% completions. He has 2 touchdowns I'm not worried about, no interceptions I'm impressed. And it's so hard to gauge a quarterback when your team is rushing for 250 yards per game and 6.0 yards per carry. If you have an offensive line and you can rush for 250 yards per game and 6.0 yards per carry, I could be a quarterback and complete 60% because it's just not a fair assessment. Obviously, the West Virginia defense, be it not good this year, is certainly better than East Carolina and West Carolina. And I'll bring it up again. These quarterbacks making first road starts, yeah, we saw some true freshmen do it week one. It's not an easy thing to do. We saw Bo Nix come back to being a very mediocre quarterback last week. We saw the Boise quarterback struggle against Marshall in that situation. And now you have a young quarterback in Matthew McKay making a first road start. It's something you clearly have to keep your eye on. Again, I won't be on either side in this game, but I would certainly lean with NC State just because my preseason numbers have them as a play still, but it'll be wait and see for me.
And the really interesting thing for me, and this is probably a sign that I was wrong on both of these teams. I upgraded NC State 4 points going into this week, as I mentioned already. I downgraded West Virginia 3 points coming into this week, and now I'm right on the number of 6.5. So that's a sign to me that I probably didn't have either one of those teams accurately rated. Maybe I'm overreacting to what NC State has done in the first couple weeks of the season here, but I clearly didn't downgrade West Virginia enough. And that's the hard part. You know, I mean, they had a kid in Austin Kendall who just had to sit there behind, you know, guys like, what, like Baker Mayfield and Kyler Murray. I mean, you know, what are you going to do? You're not going to beat those guys out for the job. So you figure he goes to West Virginia. He's got some untapped potential. We haven't seen it here yet so far. So yeah, that's part of the challenge of handicapping early season college football is, you know, what you think may not work out, and then it's how you react to it.
Adam, excuse me 1 second. How much have you moved NC State?
I moved them up 4 points.
I've only moved them up a half. You know, I look at what they did week one against East Carolina. You know, you only had a 23-18 first down edge. You won the game 34-6. And, you know, you were laying a fair number. I don't remember the top of my head. I think you were laying 18, and you won the game by 28, but you were plus two turnovers. And the next week you're losing. You're laying 41 to West Carolina. You win the game 41-0. I didn't adjust them at all. So, you know, despite me still having them higher, it just goes to show you two different people's point of views. That's a 4-point difference in the power ratings for us both looking at NC State.
All right, so I do want to touch on this game here, game 115-116, Maryland and Temple. And I'm a little bit upset with myself. I didn't play the 8.5 yesterday. My number on this game is actually 5.5. So right now I still do have some value around the key numbers to take Temple plus 7.5. I don't know what to do with Maryland. You know, you blow out Howard, that's one thing. You blow out Syracuse, that's clearly another. Now, that line did move very heavily on the Maryland side. They scored 63 points. They've scored, what, 142 points in two games here. But I'm not as impressed as maybe I should be. I think that was more of a commentary on how far Syracuse has fallen this season. So where do you have this number, and what do you think of the Terrapins so far?
I can tell you that Maryland's game last week was one of the games that I was very upset that I left off. And I left it off because of the line move. I mean, the line jumped, what, 5 points from Syracuse being favored to Maryland, at least 4 points. But, excuse me, Syracuse was the most fake top 25 team I've ever seen. My power ratings, I think I have them 55. Yes, they're going to win 9 or 10 games because they have the easiest Power 5 schedule out of every team in the Power 5. But being in that situation, that was one of the games that I'm very upset I left back. I do believe in Maryland. You know, Mike Locksley was always a good offensive coordinator, you know, and I think in the situation he is in, with having the Virginia Tech transfer, Josh Jackson, having the experience back there with Josh Jackson, yeah, he takes some shots, and he might only be completing 58%. But, you know, that's because he throws the ball downfield a lot. A 7-1 ratio to start. A defense that you know, gave up 400 yards to Syracuse, but, you know, they allowed 330 yards passing, and they only allowed 18 first downs. There were so many garbage yards in that game that, you know, I make my adjustment from that. I do like Maryland. I lean with Maryland. I don't like them now with where the line has gone. Originally, it was a situation I liked. You have to remember that Temple plays in LP Field, not LP Field, Lincoln Financial. Is that Philadelphia's field?
It is, yes.
And it's a game that they're excited to play. Anytime you make a road trip, you're going to have as many fans as Temple is. You're playing in an NFL stadium. These young kids get excited for that. These young kids like playing in NFL stadiums. They go in. It's something they watch growing up, being from that area, being from that Philly, Maryland area. And again, we're looking at a situation now. Temple is just like TCU. What do you make of them? You played one FCS team. You scored 50-plus points. You won the game 56-12. You know, but you're still a team that lost your key players last year, you know, especially on defense. And I think that's going to have a substantial edge for him. I do like the Maryland Terps this season moving forward.
And I think maybe that's one of the things I kind of overlooked a little bit about this game, the fact that it's not going to be a full-fledged home field advantage for Temple. And based on my home field formula, I do have Temple with a 3.5-point home field edge in most games. This is one where I probably should have taken the time to adjust that number down, because this will be certainly a more split crowd. If I adjust that number down, I wind up being closer to the number that's out there. So maybe it is a good thing, you know, to do this type of show, to be able to organize your thoughts a little bit better. So I probably should downgrade Temple's HFA a little bit here, which does bring me closer to the number. So I'm glad you caught that. I'm glad you mentioned that. And I'm glad it's something that I can make an adjustment on here, you know, before I wind up tying myself to a Temple ticket with a little bit of an overlay here in this game. But Rolf, before we move on to the NFL, anything else on the Saturday card that you're kind of interested in? I know we bounced around a little bit before we started talking about the three games specifically, but anything else that's kind of on your radar here?
Well, you know, a couple things I want to mention. You know, I tweet this out each week, but I think it's important for people to remember some teams that may be overvalued this week or even next week. I just want to mention the teams that won their game outright but were outgained, so you can find some value in these situations. Wyoming beat Texas State 23-14. Wyoming was outgained 444 to 293, a negative 151 yards. North Carolina was outgained against Miami by 99 yards. BYU outgained to Tennessee by 79. Penn State was outgained against Buffalo. I heard a lot of people say, oh, we got to up Penn State's power ratings. They won 45-13 as a 30-point favorite. Well, they got outgained 429 to 357. App State, probably the most surprising, a 22.5-point favorite, gave up 526 yards to Charlotte, getting outgained 458 to 526. La Tech got outgained against Grambling, 455 to 390. Cal got outgained against Washington, 348 to 303. And Colorado, only a 5-yard edge in a 4-point game, but they got outgained 469 to 464 in that loss to Nebraska. Excuse me, Colorado. Go ahead. Colorado got outgained in the win to Nebraska in the overtime win.
That game, I was on Nebraska. I actually wound up with a -3.5 that was out there. I think it got down to as low as -3. That is a game I would like to never talk about again. I don't know how the hell that happens. The 96-yard flea flicker, I knew I was screwed from that point forward. I don't know how that happens. I have no idea how you're
my top play of the week as well. So,
like, you're so in control of that game. And quite frankly, it's probably a good segue into the NFL, because this is something that Brian Blessing and I ranted about for the first 10 or 15 minutes of our segment. These NFL coaches are a joke. The play calling sucks. The clock management sucks. The prevent defense, all it does is prevent you from covering and winning the game. It's hard enough to bet the NFL without these guys that have no clue what they're doing.
Yeah, it's sort of like Mac Brown taking a knee. Okay, well, you know, yeah, we've seen some interesting situations, and I agree with you. The differences on some of these teams from the first half to the second half is one thing, but when you're watching on TV and you're watching with a table of eight guys and everyone says the exact same thing and the coach doesn't realize it, you know that it's not just you, that it really is some stupid coaching moves.
Well, I mean, like I said in the previous segment, I mean, You've got kids that are probably going to fail out of college that are sitting around playing Madden in their dorm rooms that have a better idea of game theory and clock management than these head coaches. It's remarkable. I just, for the life of me, I can't figure it out. Kicking bad field goals, taking ill-advised timeouts, awful play calls. You know, even Sean Payton, you know, with some questionable decisions yesterday. You've got Drew Brees. You've got Alvin Kamara. You have all these weapons. And sometimes you just scratch your head about some of these calls. I mean, Mike Tomlin thoroughly outcoached in week one. I mean, just massively outcoached. It's crazy because, again, the NFL is hard enough to beat on its own without having to factor in these guys that just they wear tinfoil hats around on Sundays.
Yeah, the two minute drills seem to have gone out the window. Clock management seems to go out the window. Coaches don't know what to do on 1- and 2-point conversions. They have to look at their analytic charts. Coaching has become more and more of let's try to keep peace in the locker room and let's not worry and hurt the feelings of our players. Well, I tell you what, Bill Belichick doesn't worry about how his players feel, and that's part of the reason he's successful.
You know how you keep locker rooms happy? You win games. Everyone talks about all these great locker rooms and this chemistry and all this bullshit. You keep people happy by winning games and going to the playoffs and having a chance at winning a Super Bowl ring. That's how you keep guys happy. You know, I mean, all right, anyway. So going from week one to week two here, from a betting standpoint, as opposed to this rant I'm probably going to do every day on the week this or every day on the show this week, from a betting standpoint, what were your week one to week two takeaways?
Well, this isn't a surprise. And, you know, I think last week we talked about the Patriots defense with Bill Belichick being his own DC now for the first time in 4 years and calling his plays. We saw it in the preseason. We saw it week one. You get another veteran in AB going there. I upped the Patriots 3 points in my power ratings, and I made them 3 points clean of everyone else in the NFL right now. I just think they are the superior team. You know, we see the normal overreactions week one with Baltimore and Miami and, you know, looking at what those look ahead lines, but you know, we've seen some crazy, crazy line moves from the look aheads. New England was 11 last week at the Superbook when they posted their look aheads. Now we're seeing what, 18 or 18 and a half. It'll be the second largest away favorites role in the NFL since 1989. 20 is the highest, by the way. The Houston reaction with 6.5 points, that the injury to Foles. Baltimore moved 4 points with their win against Miami when they're facing Arizona. And a game we'll talk about, I believe, the Bills. The Bills moved 3.5 points. And the Bengals. The Bengals moved 3.5 points. Bengals were +2.5 in the look-ahead line. Now they're the favorite. And I watched that Cincinnati game. You know, a new coach, I like watching at least a half of week one and getting a feel. I was impressed. I really did. I liked the Bengals. I mean, people had them down as a team that was automatically third in the North. And I really came away with it and said, man, Andy Dalton looks like a brand new quarterback this week with the new coaching staff. So, you know, obviously one game does not tell us, especially since they lost that game, but the Bengals probably impressed me as much as anyone besides the Patriots.
Yeah, the Bengals impressed me too. And I mean, they're going to be on my Super Contest and Circa Million cards here this week and quite possibly the Golden Nugget as well. I mean, Andy Dalton threw for 418 yards and AJ Green didn't even play. I mean, that's astonishing to me. And also too, Cincinnati only gave up 2.9 yards per carry. They did a very good job against that Seattle running attack. You know, Russ did his thing and did just enough to win, of course, as he always seems to do. But Cincinnati's defense played well. Taylor likes his weapons at the skill positions. Again, the Bengals covered the number. Joe Mixon had 10 rushing yards and 17 total yards of offense, and they didn't have A.J. Green. I mean, that's a remarkable coaching performance and a remarkable Dalton performance, really, for Cincinnati. So, I mean, they're going to be on my cards here this week. And, you know, maybe I am overreacting to one game, but when you look at all the things that go in Cincinnati's favor regarding that one game, You know, it's still impressive. Of course, they had 400 and, you know, they had 400 passing yards and only managed 20 points. So I guess there's that. But, you know, still, it's it was a good showing for the Bengals, to be sure. I do want to ask you about this game here, Rolf. Game 263-264. And I'm going to mention this at the top so you can look up the stat if you don't have it already. But I mentioned in the first segment, teams coming off of NFL or coming off of overtime games in the NFL have not done well against the spread. So I do know that. I don't know if you have that stat in front of you. But the interesting thing here is that these two teams are both coming off of an overtime game. So it's obviously going to cancel it out in this game. But I was wondering if you had that stat for the other teams it's relevant for here this week.
I could tell you that teams off a tie are 4-10 against the spread. And yes, I will be able to tell you what they are if we talk for a few seconds.
Okay, we can do that. And you know, the tie thing makes sense because you wind up playing, you know, an extra 10 or 15 minutes of football. That's a lot. You know, it's an extra handful of plays for both teams. It's, you're basically playing an entire fifth quarter. So it does make sense that, you know, those teams do struggle that following week.
All right, Adam. Teams that
I apologize. I put you on the spot. That's on me.
That's all right. I'm just looking up the database, so it's taking me a second. Teams that were at overtime at home and are at home again this week since 2010 have gone 10-25-3 against the spread, 28.6%. But how about this? Teams that were on the road in overtime and are on the road again this week, I don't know if that applies to anyone, have actually gone 28-19-2, 59.6% against the spread. So I think at home, when you're on the road, you're on the road, you're on the road again, you probably get a huge line overreaction. And those teams, again, 28-19-2 ATS, a pretty substantial situation. Totals-wise, those home teams that are home again that have a negative ATS record of 28.6% have gone 24-13-1 to the over, 65% to the over. That's really the only high over-under number there is in that group.
All right, so as far as this handicap here with the Chargers and the Lions, again, Chargers play, you know, they just get an extra drive in overtime. They go down the field and score, the game's over. But now they've got a long trip from L.A. to Detroit where they are laying a road number of 2.5 or some juice threes.
Well, let me make an adjustment to that statement. They, of course, still connected to the DeBartolos. They are actually practicing in Youngstown this week. So they are going from Tampa to Youngstown, will practice and stay in Youngstown all week, and then make the short trip down to Cincinnati to not do the double flight.
Okay. All right, so that's the situation there for San Francisco. What about this Chargers and Detroit game here where the Chargers are a 2.5-point favorite?
Oh, my bad. See, I'm listening to Chargers and thinking San Francisco in my head. My apologies.
All good.
Folks, that's what happens when you get real, real old and it's football time and you're doing podcasts on Tuesday morning. My complete apologies, spazzing out on that. You know,
that's an excellent note because we think about teams going all the way back home, you know, San Francisco not going home, just going up to Youngstown. It's interesting too, because like you've got a situation here this week, New Orleans comes off Monday night and a dramatic win at that, plays the Rams. And then in week three, they're at Seattle. So it's important to know if these teams are going back home, are going to be somewhere different, somewhere strange, somewhere new, something like that. So a good point. I mean, it was, you know, it's a happy accident, we'll call it. We'll channel Bob Ross here. Just call it a happy accident with that note about San Francisco.
I'm gonna expand on that note one more time. I don't have any records on this. It happened a few times where teams have stayed out west or teams have stayed out east. But I do remembering reading about Hawaii football. When they used to play multiple games, they used to stay on the mainland on occasion if it's earlier in the year and school had just started or was previously starting. And often you read about the camaraderie and how teams bonded that week. And they're not going home to their families every night. It's not a work situation. They're staying in hotels or in a place where you are spending the entire week together. So we'll see what happens. I don't know if anyone's done an article on it, but a note to see what happens with San Fran this week. As far as Detroit goes, again, Detroit was a team that, you know, moved the ball, but everything is with an asterisk. You have to remember that Arizona last year was outgained by 117 yards per game. That was the most in the NFL since 1999. The Browns' first year, I think, when they were back. So they were a historic bad team. So going to Arizona and having a 90-yard edge and having a two-first-down edge is nothing that you really can hang your hat on. But this Charger team, to me, just does not look like the same team. You know, yes, you're missing Gordon. I'm not worried about him. But you're missing James on defense. You're missing an offensive lineman. Phillip Rivers looks older to me than he has in the past. And I have the Chargers as one of the top teams, you know, in the AFC, but their game against Indy did not impress me. I think I lean with Detroit in this game. I mean, the NFL still early in the week, so no strong statements for me in the NFL. But I think Detroit, you know, you have a tie, okay? For half the teams, you start the season with a tie. That's a detriment. But the Detroit Lions, even though you blew that lead, you come out of it, you haven't lost a game yet, now you have your home opener, your fans are still excited, you're probably going to have the noisiest crowd you're going to have. I think I'm going to back the Lions in this game.
That's interesting. You know, I wasn't overly impressed with what the Chargers did. I know they played very, very slowly. I know they had some big plays. Maybe they ran the football well at times. The thing about Detroit is it just, you know, we had that coaching rant at the top of the segment here. I don't know if I can trust Matt Patricia in really any type of situation here. You know, supposed to be this big defensive mind. New England hasn't missed a beat without him. They're probably better off without him this year with Belichick as the DC. I can't trust Patricia against any sort of competent team. And the Chargers look like a pretty competent team right now. So maybe one thing I can suggest here, I think Detroit could be a popular teaser candidate going from 2.5 up to 8.5. With a game where the total is getting a little bit higher, but it's still not that high at 48.
Yeah. You know, the one thing that I like the Detroit D-line. I mean, yes, you're playing a rookie quarterback, but, you know, on the road to get 5 sacks, I think that could be the difference in the game. I think they're gonna get to Rivers 3 or 4 times. And when Rivers takes that many sacks in a game and he's getting pressured, he tends to get happy feet. So if the Detroit defensive line plays like I expect against a banged up Chargers O-line, Lions can win the game.
All right, so one other game I wanted to tackle with you here, the Bills and the Giants. And I think this one's interesting. I think this one's kind of strange. I don't know if you've read anything about the situation for Buffalo. I presume they're just going home, but playing back-to-back games at the Meadowlands against different opponents, it's kind of weird. I don't know if that's ever happened before that I can remember, but they are right back there in New Jersey, this time taking on the Giants. Buffalo opened a 2.5-point favorite. It's kind of 2 pretty much market-wide now, total up a tad to 43.5. Any thoughts on this one?
The funny thing is the Bills have played more regular season games in Giants Stadium than the Giants have this year. I think it's an advantage. You know, I think it's being on the same sideline. I believe it happened once. Someone made a road trip back-to-back games probably 3 or 4 years ago. And for some reason, I do remember that exact scenario. But listen, color me impressed by the Bills defense. Yes, you're playing a young Jets defense, but you're playing a young Jets team, but they have Le'Veon Bell to hold the Jets to 223 yards in week one. And you say, well, Buffalo gave up 16 points. No, part of that was on a pick six. So they really only gave up one touchdown. I completely believe in this Bills defense. I like what the offense did. I like that they're going to a non-Bills type offense more often where they're spreading out some of the receivers. I think it's giving Josh Allen not only more time to throw, but some rush lanes where he can take off and not feel like he's stuck in the pocket. I am on the Bills. So it's a situation where I do like them. I do have a weird stat to throw out last week. Since 2010, The Bills at one point were minus four turnovers, and that's why they were down 16-0 at the half. But since 2010, teams that were plus three turnovers in the game were 427-23-1. They won 94.9% of the game. That's the situation the Jets were in, and the Jets just found another way to lose, even though they were in a roll plus three turnovers. Again, only 23 teams and 451 times have lost being plus three turnovers. So, again, I think the Bills are the best defense in football, and I will be on them this week.
Rolf Michaels, professional handicapper over at WagerTalk.com. What do you guys got going on over there right now, man?
Well, we talked a lot about power ratings, and I do post my power ratings every Sunday, and I also post the entire power rating situation week by week. So you can see exactly how far I've gone up since the beginning, how much I make each adjustment for each week. You have the I post the first pitch for baseball, the gridiron guide for football. And again, a lot of neat systems and angles if you're following me on Twitter, at CalSportsLV. I don't really give my personal opinion on Twitter. I just like sharing gambling information to help people become better bettors.
Once again, that's Rolf Michaels over at WagerTalk.com, at CalSportsLV on Twitter. Rolf, appreciate the time as always, man. I know you're a very, very busy guy doing a lot of shows. You got Gold Sheet stuff going on. You got a lot going on here on a weekly basis. So I appreciate that you take some time to join us, and looking forward to talking to you again next week.
Always a blast, Adam. Thank you.
There you go. Once again, professional handicapper Rolf Michaels over at WagerTalk.com. Coming up on our Wednesday edition of Bang the Book Radio, we'll chat with Brian Leonard, professional handicapper over at WagerTalk.com, and also Wes Reynolds at Wes Reynolds the number one on Twitter. We'll get his thoughts on the golf event here this week and do some more college football and NFL with those guys. Thursday, Brad Powers will join me. Friday, Super Contest segment, and Brent from DSI Sportsbook. That'll do it for me. Thank you so much for listening, everybody, and I will talk to you again tomorrow.